Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present John Hickey, Executive Director of the Missouri Citizen Education Fund, who says that former Senator John Ashcroft's association with white supremacist groups makes him the wrong choice for the nation's highest law enforcement position as Attorney General. John Passacantando, Executive Director of Greenpeace USA, who discusses what's at stake for environmental policy if Gail Norton, President Bush's nominee to head the Interior Department, is confirmed by the US Senate. And Patricia Ireland, President of the National Organisation for Women, who assesses the strength and spirit of progressive groups preparing to confront the policy agenda of the new Bush administration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The new Bush administration could provide peace activists with plenty of opportunities to kill outdated weapons systems. That is the contrarian view of Pentagon critic Lawrence Korb, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the early 1980s and today advocates a $50 billion cut in military spending. Korb told a recent gathering of 80 peace activists in Greenwich, Connecticut, that the Clinton administration was always afraid to get tough with Pentagon generals out of fear of being attacked as soft on defense. To make his point, Korb reminded his audience that during the 2000 election campaign, Al Gore promised twice the military spending increase than the $45 billion that George Bush favored. Now, Korb is pushing the new administration to cancel the new DD-21 destroyer that would cost taxpayers $25 billion. He also pointed out that it was Colin Powell who last pushed for a major reduction in U.S. military force levels across the globe, and Dick Cheney, as Secretary of Defense, who tried to cancel the Osprey aircraft that is now mired in scandal. A real political firefight could break out between the Bush administration and Pentagon brass if the new president decides to cancel a whole generation of weapons. But the new administration's strong support for construction of a treaty-busting missile defense system will most likely be the focus of debate and target for peace groups over the next 4 years. The news magazine In These Times reports that President George W. Bush could face his first real political test in late January as the U.S. Navy resumes military exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. The naval maneuvers, after a 2-year lapse due to determined civilian protests, will resume using inert bombs and dummy ammunition. It will also be a test of the agreement signed last year between then-President Clinton and Puerto Rico Governor Pedro Rosselló, calling for a 3-year phase out of live bombing on the island that has been used for military exercises since World War II. The Vieques agreement was dismissed by activists in Puerto Rico who call for an immediate withdrawal of the U.S. military from the island. Most of the Pentagon brass and their allies in Congress, however, want to continue to use Vieques for naval exercises. In elections last fall, Governor Rosselló's pro-statehood New Progressive Party was thrown out of power, largely over public opposition to the agreement. The new governor, Sila Calderón of the Popular Democratic Party, has called for the U.S. Navy to pull out of Vieques. She is also organizing a public referendum calling for the U.S. Navy to cease operations on the island. The U.S. military has a long history in Puerto Rico. In 1898, the U.S. Navy bombed the port of San Juan during the Spanish-American War, and the island has been a colony of the United States ever since. Today, the U.S. Navy is still trying to hold on to its old imperial possessions. Pentagon brass must now face off against the new Puerto Rican governor, Sila Calderón, and a majority of the population determined to free Vieques from the grips of the U.S. military. The Cold War mentality appears to be alive and well at the U.S. Department of Energy. At least that seems to be the case, given the department's vigorous defense of their contractors against any criticism. For example, Randall Wally was employed at the Hanford Nuclear Facility in Washington State as a certified pipe fitter when he noticed that the valves intended to control the flow of millions of gallons of toxic nuclear waste didn't seem sturdy enough to function safely. Rather than being commended for his concern, he and his crew were fired. This could be just one more tale of our government's embrace of the Dilbert principle, but for two disturbing elements. First, the official DOE policy, as specified in 1993 by then-Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary, clearly defines a zero-tolerance policy of reprisal against whistleblowers. Secondly, millions of tax dollars are used for settlements, litigation, and stonewalling. According to the General Accounting Office, the DOE spent $40 million in 1992 to defend its contractors. In one case alone, it paid 10 law firms with 62 attorneys, billing $200 per hour for a gross total of $500,000 in 1 month. According to Mother Jones magazine, these policies are a carryover from the Cold War days, where nuclear facilities were deemed critical to the national defense. But a less obvious reason may be because of all the big names that are part of the nuclear industry. Power players like Westinghouse, ICF Kaiser, Bechtel, and others that would rather do business in a closed universe without the inconvenient interference of workers. So despite prompting from Congress, the Department of Energy continues to fund contractors who fight prolonged legal battles against their workforce, even reimbursing contractors who ultimately lose. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Fraser and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
George W. Bush's nomination of former Missouri Republican Senator John Ashcroft to head the Justice Department has raised strong objections by civil rights, women's, and gay and lesbian groups. A hero of the conservative right, Ashcroft readily admits that if he could pass a single law, he would outlaw abortion, even in cases of incest and rape. His record of opposition to desegregation legislation and his campaign to block the nomination of a black judge to the federal bench speaks to his insensitivity to issues of race, say his critics. Ashcroft's endorsement of an avowedly pro-Confederate magazine, The Southern Partisan, labelled by some as white supremacist, should be sufficient grounds to question this nominee's qualifications for this important position, say opponents. Narrowly defeated by Democrat Mel Carnahan, who died just weeks before last November's election, leaders of the Christian right and other conservatives successfully lobbied President-elect Bush to nominate Ashcroft for Attorney General. After a week of confirmation hearings and some tough questioning, Ashcroft claims he will uphold the law of the land, despite his strongly held views. But some senators were sceptical of what they described as a confirmation conversion. John Hickey is the executive director of the Missouri Citizen Education Fund. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about why so many believe John Ashcroft is the wrong choice to occupy this nation's highest law enforcement position.
The reason we've started paying attention to John Ashcroft is as part of our right-wing monitoring project, we looked at the militia groups and the Christian identity groups and violent anti-choice groups. And in that research, we found that John Ashcroft started popping up as somebody who was reaching out to white supremacist groups for political support. And there are several instances that really jumped out at us. First, John Ashcroft did an interview in the Southern Partisan magazine in mid-1998. And in this interview, John Ashcroft committed to promote Jefferson Davis, who is, of course, the president of the Confederacy. And John Ashcroft said that Jefferson Davis and the Confederate leadership did not fight for a perverted agenda.
That would be something that you think he would remember. When he was questioned during the hearings, mm-hmm. He began by saying he had no recollection of Southern Partisan magazine or the interview. And then after continued questioning, he did finally say that he did remember. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
In the interview, John Ashcroft praised the Southern Partisan magazine. So in the interview, he displayed a knowledge of what the Southern Partisan magazine is. He said, and I quote, "Your magazine also helps set the record straight. You've got a heritage of doing that." So for John Ashcroft to say that he doesn't remember it just does not ring true. That's just it's just not a true statement. I think Ashcroft was in a corner because there was no way he could explain his statements, so he had to pretend like he didn't remember them. I think John Ashcroft's visit to Bob Jones University was another attempt to build his support amongst far-right activists in South Carolina, and in the South as a whole. For people who don't remember Bob Jones University, it's a school that for most of its history has refused to admit any black students whatsoever. It's been in the news recently because of its ban on interracial dating, but for almost 50 years, the school didn't have to worry about banning interracial dating because it just refused to accept any black students at all. So it's a school with a segregationist past. It's a school that as recently as 10 months ago on its website indicated that Catholicism was a satanic cult, and Bob Jones University said that the Pope is the Antichrist.
Well, there's a general consensus that seems to feel that John Ashcroft, even though has not been approved yet, will be approved as Attorney General. And given this kind of history, what do you think that says about him being nominated and approved?
Well, I think that says that the bulk of Americans have to weigh in and talk to their U.S. senators. Because remember, John Ashcroft was defeated for re-election in Missouri on November 7th. John Ashcroft was defeated in Missouri because John Ashcroft is too extreme for Missouri. If John Ashcroft is too extreme for Missouri, he is definitely too extreme to be the Attorney General of this country.
In listening to the hearings, the confirmation hearings, John Hickey, it was clear that what he had done in the past was contradictory to what he was saying he would uphold when he was being questioned. He clearly worked against women's right of choice. He worked as hard as he could to outlaw abortion, and yet, you know, he claimed that he was going to uphold the laws. So there seemed to be, you know, two different John Ashcrofts, and would the real John Ashcroft please stand up? And do you think that is really going to work against him?
Well, I hope our U.S. senators are wise enough to recognize that the way to measure John Ashcroft isn't what he said in those 4 days of hearings, but his 28-year record in public life, and that 28-year record is much more enlightening as to what kind of attorney general he would be than the 4 days of happy talk he gave when he was on the stand at the Judiciary Committee. I think anybody who would believe that instead of John Ashcroft's 28-year public record is foolish. I think it's just a PR spin. It's just a public relations gambit, and that we owe it to ourselves and our country to look below that and look at the real facts and look at the real record. And that's what we've been endeavoring to do, Denise, is get out John Ashcroft's record of interviewing in racist magazines like the Southern Partisan, John Ashcroft's record of going to segregationist universities like Bob Jones University, John Ashcroft's record of discrimination against African-American nominees to federal positions like Ronnie White or Henry Foster or David Satcher, and doesn't even end there. There's another issue that I was very proud to see Senator Ted Kennedy raise in the Judiciary Committee hearing, and that is how John Ashcroft set up a discriminatory system of voter registration when he was the governor. Because remember, the Attorney General is responsible for enforcing the Voting Rights Act and making sure that all people, regardless of skin color, have fair access to the ballot in this country.
That was John Hickey, Executive Director of the Missouri Citizen Education Fund. Call the fund at area code 314-531-2288 or visit their website at www.usaction.org. Gail Norton, President Bush's pick to head the Interior Department, along with John Ashcroft, is among the most controversial cabinet appointments made by the 43rd President. Norton, a protege of James Watt, spent 4 years working with the former Secretary of the Interior at the Mountain States Legal Foundation, underwritten by corporate contributors. As Colorado's Attorney General, Norton was an advocate for the state's self-audit law, which allows corporate polluters to police themselves to determine compliance with federal environmental law. Norton also worked as a lobbyist for a lead paint manufacturer that had been deemed responsible for 75 toxic waste Superfund cleanup sites. While serving as a lawyer in the Reagan administration's Interior Department from 1985 through to 1987, Norton unsuccessfully fought to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Underscoring many environmental groups' opposition to the Norton nomination, activists with Greenpeace draped a banner reading, "Our Land, Not Oil Land," over the facade of the Interior Department building the day before George Bush was sworn into office. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with John Passacantando, Executive Director of Greenpeace USA, who discusses what he believes is at stake for environmental policy if Gail Norton is confirmed by the US Senate to head the Interior Department.
Gail Norton has engaged in a lot of political activities against environmentalists, even trying to put together a front group, making more extreme anti-environmentalists and corporations that are very hostile to the environment look green with a front group that she was putting together. She has lobbied on behalf of a lead paint company, trying to advocate that lead paint doesn't cause problems, particularly in children, which it does. It lowers IQ. What we have to do is expose that past record, which doesn't necessarily make her unqualified in the Senate's eyes for the job, but it'll make it much more difficult for her to do damage, for her to roll back the protections that our country has put in place over our national lands, which, by the way, again, it's important to note, protection of our natural places, including the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is supported by a majority of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. What's my biggest fear of the Bush administration? In some ways, I don't think they ultimately will open up the Arctic Refuge to oil drilling. If they do, it would be too much in the face of it would be against public opinion, would be against what the public wants, and it would be for a handful of oil companies and oil drilling companies, and it would just look too crass for an administration that really needs to unify its base and build some support amongst Americans who are skeptical of it. But my fear is that instead of going for the real home runs for these oil companies, like opening up the Arctic Refuge, that they could do a lot of damage behind the scenes. Instead of repealing the new national monuments or pushing for Congress to do that, they could have their employees, part members of the federal government, not enforce the protections on these public lands, and really giving the ranchers and the mining interests and the oil companies sort of free rein to the public lands owned by the American public.
The confirmation of Gail Norton may in the end be up to a handful of Democrats who will throw in with the GOP. What is your message to those Senate Democrats who are looking towards reconciliation and bipartisanship in support of George Bush having a cabinet that he wants in place for himself?
What Bush needs to do, what he said he was going to do all through his campaign, and that was to be a uniter. If they want to do this president right, if they want to protect his best interests, they need to get a cabinet in there for the president who will unify the American public. So if they can be convinced that Gail Norton will unify the public and protect our public lands and enforce the laws that you need to enforce as the Interior Secretary, like the Endangered Species Act, as opposed to all her Ayn Randian rhetoric that she spewed out over 20 years about the takings clause and, you know, if there's ever federal regulations, you've got to pay people. You know, if you want to protect an endangered species and an endangered bird lands on your property, you've got to pay the citizen for having that bird. I mean, bizarre thing. Now, if Gail Norton can convince the Senate that she really will defend these laws and uphold these laws that she has had a career saying she would undermine, then they'd be okay. But the fact is, if they were to confirm Gail Norton while knowing that she's going to be disruptive to the very protections of our American lands that the public holds so dear, they will actually do the president a disservice. As, you know, if you remember when James Watt was nominated for Interior Secretary under Ronald Reagan, there were only 12 votes opposing him. But he became, in his outrageous actions, in his outrageous anti-environmental actions, such a lightning rod and so damaging to the president that ultimately they had to get rid of him.
John Passacantando, what's the state of the environmental movement in the United States as George W. Bush takes office? Do you think the wherewithal is there to resist the administration in trying to weaken environmental regulations and to do the bidding of the oil companies, as you say, in drilling in the Arctic wilderness areas?
I absolutely think it's there. And in fact, I'll predict that the Bush administration ultimately does not let the oil companies drill in the Arctic Refuge. The environmental movement is bigger, it's more powerful, it's more unified. I mean, I was at a press conference last week opposing Gail Norton's radical agenda with nearly every major environmental group in the country, with the NAACP, with the AFL-CIO. What you've got is, you know, it's pretty much an American value to protect the environment. And given that, I don't think Bush can get far with this anti-environmental agenda. And I also, actually, I don't want to demonize him or Norton. I don't want to say, you know, Gail Norton has been called James Watt in a skirt. It may be true, but I actually doubt it. I think these guys are going to see the opposition. They're going to come around. They're going to come back to the center, and they'll govern in a way that will please the American people. If not, they're just going to undermine this presidency. And really, that's not good for any American.
That was John Passacantando, Executive Director of Greenpeace USA. To contact Greenpeace, call 1-800-326-0959 or visit their website at www.greenpeaceusa.org. Thousands of people travelled to Washington, D.C. from all over the country on January the 20th to stand in freezing rain during inauguration ceremonies in order to convey their anger at what many in the crowd felt was a stolen election and the subversion of democracy. The protesters, estimated by organisers to number some 20,000, confronted unprecedented security measures, including barricaded streets and metal detection screening checkpoints all along the inaugural parade route. Housewives from Ohio, registered Republicans from Louisiana, secretaries from Detroit, students from California, and mainstream Democrats from all over, some of whom had never participated in protest demonstrations before, gathered at the Supreme Court and along Pennsylvania Avenue to hold up signs proclaiming, "Hail to the thief." Many others booed and shouted shame as a limousine carrying the new chief executive sped by through streets lined with police. Speakers at protest rallies held at various locations in Washington during the inauguration ceremony included 91-year-old Granny Dee, who fought for campaign finance reform by walking across the U.S., Reverend Al Sharpton, Dick Gregory, and Patricia Ireland, president of the National Organization for Women. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Patricia Ireland after she addressed several thousand people at a rally on Inauguration Day. She assesses the strength and spirit of progressive groups as President Bush began his first full day at work by signing an executive order ending federal funding to international family planning organizations.
Certainly when we were protesting at the inauguration of Ronald Reagan's first administration, the mood was much more bleak. I would say that the mood now is less fearful and more angry, more determined, more mobilized than in prior administrations that were Republican. While we don't have the White House or either House of Congress, and basically we don't have the Supreme Court, we do have the majority of voters in the country who opposed George W. Bush and the Republican Party platform, and now they are pissed. It isn't to me a shrewd strategy that Cheney or Bush or whomever came up with the strategy of nominating such controversial cabinet appointments. I think, in fact, that's just energized our movement. We have gotten so many phone calls, so many inquiries, so many people who want to protest. Many of them, it's the first time they've ever been out in the street, and to me that's a pretty healthy sign.
Do you think people in the next 4 years will be on the defensive, or do you see sort of a coming together of progressive forces around the nation that is, in some people's estimation, unprecedented?
I think it is unprecedented that so many different constituencies, so many organized constituencies have come together across the lines that traditionally have been used to divide us, whether it's race or class or religion or ethnicity or gender, in part because we know we have a common enemy. They use common tactics to keep us divided and to keep us weak, and in part because we are, I think, more sophisticated as movements than we've ever been. I mean, I can say to a NOW group and get nods of recognition when I say that some people argue feminists want to take power from men, which isn't true because most men haven't had power either. So, you know, when we get that kind of understanding across our movements, then I think we can not just stand together with sort of a false alliance, but now we have really deep bonds.
Democratic senators are expected to vote in some numbers for some of these more controversial cabinet nominations. What's your feeling about the Democratic senators and the Democratic Party in general in terms of their connection with the anger that's apparently out in the country after this election?
I am not one who says there's no difference between the parties or the candidates, but it is true that they are, this is a company town, and they are two branches of the same company. I think that we have got to recruit our own people. We are right now finding and promoting and cultivating and training people to run in the next election. It's a very hard thing to ask feminists, activists of any stripe to do. To work on the inside requires some compromise. It's the nature of legislation. But to see this gauntlet that Bush has thrown down, and to see so many of the Democrats falling all over themselves to say nice words about some of these nominees, is really, I think, proof positive that we have got to continue building our own movements and continue doing an electoral strategy that doesn't depend on the parties. I can remember so well the slogans that we have on bumper stickers and T-shirts, one of which says, "Women weren't born Republican, we weren't born Democrat, and we weren't born yesterday." But I think one of my favorites was, the Democrats come and sweet talk us every 2 years, and then they don't respect us in the morning. So clearly we have some work to do along those lines as well. Not all of the work has to be electoral. In fact, most of the work is makes the elections sort of the icing on the cake. What we have to do is continue to mobilize public opinion, and indeed to change public opinion on some issues. We're at a point in our movements, some 30 or 40 years down the road in most of our movements, that the majority of people already agree with us. And what we have to do is convince them that by taking action, they can make a difference. I think the worst problem is people feeling disempowered, not recognizing that they are part of a movement, that when they take an action, it's rippled and magnified all over the country. So I think that the biggest work right now is maintaining our energy, bringing more people in, and finding the ways to plug them in so that they feel like they're doing important work that is making change.
That was Patricia Ireland, president of the National Organization for Women. To contact now, call area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at www.now.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics or guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203 331 9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, at 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikatar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Harry Minot, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.